Hi, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of a day for the 24th day of Kislev. Thank you to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Brown, to David Hochhauser for putting these shiurim online, making them available to you. Today for the 24th of Kislev, we're actually going to see sort of a potpourri. I didn't find, apparently, I find them and then I come back to them again and again. I didn't find any one tshuva. It was long enough to fill our time, but I found several different tshuvot that I think have, and when they're shorter, they're less involved in terms of the back and forth of halakha, so maybe that's in some senses an advantage because it gives us a chance to hear from different mishivim on this one day, all these tshuvot written on the 24th of Kislev, and on different topics, so we get a chance to dabble, as it were. So, in chronological order of the ones that we're going to see today, Chatam Sofer in Chelek Dalet Evena Ezer Bet Siman Kuf Samech Zayin is writing to the Dayanim of Vizhnitz. Right? They have a question for him about a particular case, and he's writing to David about a marriage case, and he's writing to them, and he says, there's a guy in your kehilah that I got a letter, and that the wife, this woman named Hinda, is his wife, and she refuses, she is a moredet. And here moredet means that she refuses to engage in marital intercourse. She refuses to engage in such marital relations. And the husband has said, whatever you tell me to do, I'll do. So she's refusing to do so, and it's been more than a year. It's been more than 12 months that she's done this. And she's done it in the face of warnings from a shliach beit din, meaning the husband goes to the local beit din. I'm sorry, this response, I didn't say it. Dated the 24th of Kislev, Tuf Kuf Pei Vav, 1825. So in 1825, it's still the time, at least in Vizhnitz, where the poor man, the husband, who's being left stuck, he turns to the local beit din. He says, you got to help me. Right? So that's, I think, an important piece of what's supposed to happen in Jewish communal life. That's complicated because then you have to trust the judges, they'll do the right thing. And sadly, not all judges always do the right thing, and life gets complicated. But that's theoretically what's to be done. So he said, I'll do whatever you guys tell me. So the shliach beit din goes to her and says, listen, what happens in marriage is husbands and wives are supposed to live together. So you're refusing to live together. It's a problem. And she refuses. She just says she's not going to, and she's not going to come to court either. She's not going to come in and talk it out. She's not living with him, and she's not coming to court. So the Chatam Sofer says, since it's gone on for more than a year, it seems obvious that we can give him a heter me'er rabbanim, that's the custom, that he would leave a get for her with the court, so she's not in these situations left stuck. She's made the marriage be over. And is refusing to admit it, basically. And so that's what you think you would do. Now, there was a Beit Shmuel that seemed to imply that he couldn't get married again until he actually gave her a get, and she accepted, and that marriage was over. So Chazal says, I don't understand, and it's not our issue to get into it, but Chazal says, I don't understand. That was a situation where she wanted a get, he didn't want to give her a get, and then he wanted to get married again. So there we say, no, you can't get married again. There's a Chayr Rabbeinu Gershom that Jewish men should not marry two women, even though by Torah law it would be permitted. Jewish men don't marry two women, so you can't get married to a second woman. So when we allow through Heter Meir Rabbanim, as we've seen in other occasions, that's when there's some terrible situation that's not letting him divorce this wife, whatever it is. Insanity is one that we've spoken about. Here, it's her refusal to accept the get, and he's making sure to take care of her by giving her the get, leaving the get for her. So, but if he's the problem, if he's the one who's not letting a divorce go through, then there's not supposed to be any way that we let him get a heter meir rabbanim, let him marry again, as unfortunately happens sometimes in our times when there are people who do that. So we don't allow that to happen. This is a Chatam Sofer. If he's the one who's causing the problem, if she's the one who doesn't want the get, then you can't leave him. And he says, Pashut she'ein la'an gol olam. It's obvious that you shouldn't leave him. Just like we would not want a woman to be an aguna, we don't want him to be an agun. We don't want him to be stuck in a situation where he cannot live a happily married, a married life, right? We can't guarantee him happiness. We can guarantee him that he can go off and try to look and find a marriage. So the two options are that he would divorce her against her will, which also is not something that Rabbeinu Gershom was happy with, or we let him marry a second wife. So the general custom is to let him marry a second wife. That's preferable to a get al korcha. So instead, you just leave the get for her, and there you do. Sorry, I didn't mean to mumble. You leave the get for her, and he can go off and get married to a second wife. Then he adds, he had heard that the reason that she was refusing to have marital relations was that she's already had two experiences. And this is a sad part of the story. She said two experiences where after she gives birth, they write mishtagat. So mishtagat literally means goes crazy, but I would wonder and bet that they might mean something like postpartum, a serious postpartum depression. Now, postpartum depression is something that's not adequately treated, as far as I can tell, in our time. There are many women who say they had it, and it didn't get sufficiently treated. They didn't know what to do about it. They didn't find the right treatment, and when they looked for treatment, they didn't get the right treatment. People just say, oh, you're just a little down in the dumps. Don't worry about it. So you can imagine that in 1825, it was maybe even less adequately treated. So she's found herself so not in her right mind after having two children. She's worried to get pregnant again. And she's worried that if she gets pregnant again, she'll become permanently insane. It'll just drive her off the deep end, whatever the right phrase there would be. And therefore, she's saying she's not going to have relations until menopause. And then once there's menopause, she wants to come back and live again with her husband. So she, and they're, right now, it says in the tshuva, they're young. So I don't know what young means, but in 1825, it's not impossible that they got married as teenagers. And if they had two children, and she had a bad postpartum, so let's say they're 25, and let's say she's going to hit menopause, at 40. So her plan is, so for 15 years, we won't have relations. And then we'll have, the sunset years of our lives, we'll all be happy. So that's not a plan. Now, part of what the tragedy is, and this is the tshuva's on the books, and this is what they're going to do. Part of the tragedy is that if only there was a way to convince her that they had some meaningful way to deal with her postpartum depression, or, and this doesn't come up in the tshuva at all, I'm not sure why, or theoretically, if they could find a way to give her or to allow her some kind of effective contraception. So I'm not saying that that's allowed. You'd have to talk about it. Maybe it wasn't allowed. But let's say they had a boy and a girl, so he's fulfilled the mitzvah of period of rivya. And therefore, you can say we can allow you some kind of contraception so you won't get pregnant. There might have been ways to salvage this marriage. But in any case, in this situation, there wasn't. And so the idea that he's going to be a mugan, he's going to be left without really a marital relationship for all those years, so that doesn't make any sense. Nobody really understands that. Nobody thinks that Rabbeinu Gershom, when he made his cherim, he meant anything like that. And therefore, that's the way I see it. But as the Chatam Sofer, this is 1825, so he's not a young man. I think he's in his mid-50s by this point, I'm pretty sure. So maybe a little younger, maybe certainly at least in his mid-40s. So he's not a young man, and yet he's the Chatam Sofer, and yet he says, but don't just listen to me. You can't act based on what I'm saying, but I'm going to tell you my opinion, and then you consult with the rabbis Lavov, who I've heard have already been told about this story, and whatever everybody says, that's what you should do. So that's the first brief tshuva that we're going to see today. The question of Heter Merabanim, it's another example, and we see many of them, but I have to say, they come up very, very often. It's not like, I guarantee you that it's not every time I see a chance to talk about this, because I really try to get a range of topics and a range of issues. So if you think that I'm coming back to the same issues over and over again, I promise you it's only because they're popping up over and over again, and they seem to reflect something in the tshuva. So an example of marriages that have broken down sadly, and what seems to be everybody irrevocably, and one party is not willing to live up to their responsibilities in terms of letting the marriage split up and go and let each side go their separate ways. So this is one of the options of what happened. So that's the first responsum that we saw from 1825 from the 24th of Kislev. A second responsum, Shut Piskei Uziel B'She'elot HaZiman Samech. Rav Uziel, I think, published like as a separate volume. He has Shut Mishpatei Uziel. That's a book of responsa in general, whatever comes up. And Piskei Uziel B'She'elot HaZiman is like current events questions that came up in my life. So this is number 68, and this is about the Bnei Yisrael. The Bnei Yisrael were a group of, they looked a lot like Jews. They were somewhat like Jews in India, and the question was their halachic status, because they didn't observe Judaism, as we'll see in a second. They didn't observe Judaism in any full kind of a way, and they were a sort of a test case for what then later on would become what to do with the Ethiopian Jews. And this response was on the 24th of Kislev of Tafshin Dalid. I'm pretty sure that's 1943. By the time we get to late Kislev and early Tevet, I think every so often, 24th of Kislev might, I think 24th Kislev is always still 1943 rather than 1944. She's writing to Rabbi Rafael Antebi, who is a rabbi apparently in the ear of Bombay, which is funny because today we call it Mumbai, but they called it Bombay. You can see how, in the Hebrew writing of it, you can see how Mumbai, as the Indians pronounce it, the people of India pronounce it, would be turned into Bombay. Because he writes it as Bet Vav Mem Bet Aleph Yud. So Bet Aleph Yud is really Bai in Halacha, in Hebrew. So then Bet Vav Mem, is it Bom? But it could be Boom. So if it's Mumbai, and you say really quickly, the Mumbai, it's true. Anyway, not our topic. So He gets a letter from Herzog. He says, I got a letter from Herzog about your question, about this group of people. They call themselves the Bnei Yisrael, and they act in a lot of ways like Jews, but there are some serious ways that they don't act like Jews. They don't have gittin. So gittin is like the crucial one, because if they get married, and let's suppose for a second they're Jews, and they get married, and they don't know about gittin, then that means that any time a woman gets divorced and has children from the second husband, those children are mamzerim. It happens once in a generation, twice in a generation, you could say, well, we don't know who they are, and maybe we could ignore it. But if you've had hundreds of years of Jews doing this, then all of a sudden you have to start thinking, is it true that I might have to worry that a random member of the Bnei Yisrael that I encounter is a mamzer? They also don't have chalitza and yibum, so they're missing lots of things. They don't have kohanim and levim. Now, it's not clear in the tshuva whether they don't have them. They know about they don't have them, or they don't even know about what this thing is. It sounds like they don't even know what the thing is. So the question is, can you marry them? Can you include them in a minyan? Can you call them up to the Torah as a Jew? Do they count as Jews? Now, decades later, when this question came up in terms of the Ethiopian Jews, there was a whole big fight about it, and I think we've discussed some of it. I think that we had a tshuva, we discussed what's a tshuva of Rav Avad Yosef, where he was very strongly in favor of believing that they are Jews. He had a Radvaz from hundreds of years before that claimed they're from the tribe of Dan, and they were Jews, and this, and this, and this. But others said, like Rav Moshe Feinstein, basically, one of the things they said was, it's probably better if we assume they're not Jews, because then we don't have to worry about mamzerut issues. We don't have to worry about the legitimacy of the children in terms of intermarrying, because in terms of marrying into the Jewish people, because a mamzer can never marry ordinary Jews. So if you don't know the history, there's no way you could get at the history, and the halachic standards all the same, in a lot of ways, it's easier if they're not Jewish. Meaning, if they're not Jewish, but they say they want to be Jews, and we say, you thought of yourself as Jews all these years, and therefore, we are happy to welcome you into the Jewish people, and we'll convert you, in a lot of halachic ways, that's easier. There are factual questions here, too, and I'm not getting to the factual question. I'm saying, if we can't get at the factual reality. So, whether or not the Bnei Yisrael are actually Jews, we don't know. Right? We don't really know. So the question is, can you treat them as Jews? A man meets a very nice Bnei Yisrael, one of these Indian women, Bnei Yisrael, and wants to marry her. Is he allowed to? She's Jewish. So if she converted and he's not a Kohen, of course they can marry. The question is this. Or a Bnei Yisrael walks into a Jewish house and says, I want a Bnei Yisrael. Can you count them in a minyan? Can you get them in Aliyah? So Rav Oziel says, I was already asked this question back in Tuf Reish Tzadichet, 1937, 1938. Rav Oziel says, and I assume that they were actually Jewish. They're called Bnei Yisrael, and I think they come from Jewish roots, and I relied on a tshuva of quoting the name of, I think, Rav Haigon in Shari Tshuva, and the Rambam wrote to Chachmei Lunel, they were talking that the Jews in India don't know the written Torah, and they don't know very much about the Jewish people, but what the Rambam writes is that they have a Brit Milah, they circumcise themselves, and they refrain from work on Shabbat. Now, if they don't know much Torah, clearly what they're refraining from work is going to be as much symbolic as technical halachic, because we don't actually think that significant issue in Shabbat is work in the sense of going to work. So it might be they don't light any fires in Shabbat, they don't plant on Shabbat, right? There might be a lot of things that they understand as work, and therefore they don't do it, but it won't be a full observance of Shabbat. But the Rambam refers to them as Jews, and so Rav Uziel says, and that's certainly, obviously, the forefathers of these people. Now, Rav Uziel doesn't get into it, but the truth is that even if, and I apologize for this interpolation, as I always say, if you don't like my interpolations, or even if you do, or if you're neutral, feel free to contact me at grothst@gmail.com, and let me know what you're thinking. But even if the Rambam said that in the 1100s when the Rambam lived, and he said that about the Jews of India, and let's assume for a second that he was right, because that's not always true either. It could be, with all due respect to the Rambam, it could be that the historical facts were different, right? It could be that there was a group of people in India who met one random Jew who told them the basics of his lifestyle, and then he left, and they said, oh, I like that lifestyle, I'm going to adopt it, and it sort of stuck. Some of the practices sort of stuck, and they thought of themselves as the Jewish people. That's also a possibility. And it happens, you see it. You see people who take on certain practices, and they say, yeah, I think many American, well, whatever, different topic. Could theoretically happen. So, but let's assume the Rambam was right, and let's assume that Rav Uziel is right, that they were the forefathers of these people. You'd have to
also be sure, and this came up in the case of the Ethiopian Jews as well, you'd have to also be positive that they didn't intermarry with non-Jews without proper conversion to a significant enough extent that enough non-Jewish women were joining the Jewish people and having children, and those children weren't Jewish, and they were having children, and they were having children, such that you'd have to think that even if their forefathers were this, and they maintained these traditions all the way through, they still might not be Jewish. In any case, that's not the way the Rav Uziel goes with it. Rav Uziel says that tshuva of the Rambam clearly is a foreshadowing of this group of people that we're encountering, and therefore I think that they're Jewish. But now, in terms of marrying into the Jewish people, so I went through all of the shitot, all of the opinions about the issue, about Karaim. That's another place where it came up. There were Karaites starting in the 8th or 9th century, and the Karaites have different laws about marriage and divorce than ordinary Jews do. So did you have to worry about whether, like, the same question, whether or not they might have gotten divorced without a get, without a proper halachic divorce, and therefore children from the second marriage are mamzerim, maybe over hundreds of years, they become enough mamzerim in the people that you'd have to worry about it. Because remember that once somebody's a mamzer, or a mamzeret, male or female, their child is a mamzer or a mamzeret forever. So that, you know, let's say in 1200, one woman gets divorced, gets remarried, has three children. Those three children in 1200, by the time we meet them in 1937, by the time we meet them, hundreds of years, which means three or four times that of generations of people have been mamzerim coming from them, to the extent that they are alive and well and they all have children, then you have lots and lots of mamzerim. So, Rav Uziel says, I went into that at length in Shut Mishpatei Uziel, Chelek Eben HaEzer, and I brought a Shut Rivash and a Tashbitz and a Dr. Moshe Eben HaEzer, about another group that had that problem, the what they call in halacha the anusim, which are very well known in history as either the Maranos, which is a negative term, or the conversos. But the Jews who from 1391 to 1492 were converted to Christianity, either against their will or they felt pressured to do it, and then they tried to maintain connection to the Jewish people still. So they too, if they got divorced, they didn't have a halachic get, and therefore their shul might be mamzerim. So that was another place where this came up as a discussion of the extent to which we have to worry about, and we have to be concerned that a group of people who aren't observing, who are connected to Judaism in some way, they may have come from Jews or not, but they're connected to Judaism in some way, and they're having marriages, but not divorces. At what point do we have to worry that enough of them are mamzerim, enough of them are the progeny of marriages that were halachically adulterous marriages? They weren't intentionally adulterous, but halachically adulterous, and therefore created mamzerut. So those are the places where you get it. You get it from the Karaite discussion, you get it from the Converso discussion, and then it becomes an important issue for the Bnei Yisrael discussion, and an important issue years later for the Ethiopian discussion. So Uziel at the time concluded that this group of Bnei Yisrael are in fact descendants of Jews, and you don't have to think of them as Karaim. And part of the issue with Karaim wasn't only the technical worry about their observance of Halacha, it was that they had rejected the traditional version of Torah. I mean, the Karaites assumed that they knew how to infer halakha from the Torah on their own in ways that didn't follow the ways of Chazal. So the fact that they didn't follow the ways of Chazal made that they were apikorsim in the technical sense. They were denying Chazal's tradition. And that was part of what happened with the decision about whether we could marry them or not. It wasn't a pure technical calculation of what percentage of them could and must be thought of as mamzerim. It was about their rejection of traditional Judaism as well. So these Bnei Israel, who haven't rejected anything, they just forgot the Torah because they were in a faraway exile in a place where they didn't have any connection to Torah sources, so they didn't know what they were doing. So you should be able to think that maybe we don't have to treat them as mamzerim. Then he throws in, and I think this is a point that comes up in other contexts as well that we don't think about, but since after they rejoined with Jewish groups, meaning when in World War in the 30s and 40s, I think there was a relatively thriving Jewish community, an ordinary Jewish community in Mumbai and other places in India. I knew a guy. I know a guy who now lives in Israel whose father recently, in the last couple of years, passed away. And at the Shiva, they had a family history, and he had grown up for some of his years in Mumbai, because the family had a business there, a long-standing business. So I think Rav Uziel says, they're meeting up with Jewish communities, and they're seeing Jews practicing halakha in the way that halakha requires of them. They should have rejoined the Jewish people. So since they didn't rejoin the Jewish people, then maybe he thinks they're called poshim. They're called rebellious Jews who are willfully violating halakha. Now, this is Rav Uziel writing in a time when a lot of those issues weren't as alive for him or practical for him as we might think about. But that's it can become an extremely stringent statement, because if you're going to say that any Jew who is not currently observing the Torah and who we could halakhically categorize as a Tinok Shenishba, as somebody who grew up in an environment where they didn't know what Judaism was about, but if your standard is that as soon as they see Jews keeping the Torah in something approximating the right way, because I'm not saying the Jews of Mumbai at the time were so firm and so observant, but they had the basic structures of halakha to it, you're going to say that the refusal to rejoin turns you into poshim. That would say a lot about, let's just say, reform and conservative Jews. So that's a very, that's a standard that can become a system that I fully understand, because his point is, you can't claim ignorance when you see it in front of you. I think today other people would counter argue that since you're not convinced that they're right and you're wrong, maybe it's not yet rebellion, and I'm not getting into that question. I'm just pointing out Rav Uziel's position on this issue. And he points out the Rav Ash said that about the Anusim, about the conversos, meaning we had room to be lenient with conversos on various issues, but let's say a converso flees, manages to get out of a Catholic area where he's required, where in the Catholic areas of Spain, of Europe at the time, if you were in a Catholic area, then once you converted, you can never leave, even if the conversion was against your will. But a lot of people would flee and get to places where the Protestants were in charge, I think, like Amsterdam was a place like that. Once you got to a place where you were able to convert back, so the Rav Ash says if you refused to, if you didn't, so then you're a poshea. And as a poshea, you're a willful violator of the Torah. And that has many ramifications, but it does create a particular kula. The particular leniency that it creates is harein nisuehen betelin, that their marriages don't count as Jewish marriages. Now, he doesn't get into why that is, but that's the halachic stance to take. That if you're, I think it might be something along the lines of what Moshe Feinstein said hundreds of years, centuries, no, I'm not, said, this was the Rav Ash talking, centuries after the Rav Ash, but right around the same time as Rav Uziel, that if we say in our marriage ceremonies, Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, that a man is marrying the woman according to the laws of Moshe v'Yisrael, and somebody is a rebellious Jew who doesn't believe in those laws, doesn't accept those laws, doesn't follow those laws, then the marriage isn't a marriage. And that has many downsides. But an upside of it is that even if that marriage ends without a divorce, children from later marriages won't be mamzerim, because they won't be having conceived as an extramarital affair. And he said, and at the end of that tshuva, I also quoted Natronaigo. This is going back even, you know, further into the pre-1000 stage in the 8th or Natronaigo, and I feel like it was in the 9th century, but I could be wrong, it would be in the 10th century, but early. And Reverend Natronaigo wrote about those people who have left the path of Judaism, a reminder that leaving the path of Judaism has been with us ever since there's been a Judaism. And it's not, you know, when people bemoan assimilation and loss of observance and all those things, they're terrible tragedies, but they're not new terrible tragedies. It's not like some new phenomenon. It's always been a challenge to keep all the Jewish people within the fold. Sort of a natural. Now he goes and writes about these people who have left the Jewish path and their prutzim ba'arayot, and their sexual ethics is not close to what the Jews are. They do things that are wrong, which would mean, I think it would mean things like they have extramarital affairs. It might mean homosexuality, for all I know. He doesn't say. It's they engage in sexuality that the Torah is against. Now, you could say it's with relatives, but I feel like relatives has been a taboo for lots and lots of people for much of history that have nothing to do with religion. So I find it hard to imagine that he means that they're having, you know, relationships with their mothers or sisters. But in any case, and they don't write ketubot, they don't write marriage documents when they're getting married, which is a halacha you're supposed to do, and they don't write divorces, and they don't do chalitza, and they don't do yibum, meaning if sadly a man passes away without children, the wife just marries the widow, marries whoever she wants to, without even worrying about the halacha that she's supposed to either marry a brother of her deceased husband's or get a chalitza from that brother before she marries somebody else. Or an Atranagon says, we can't include them in the Jewish people. Now, you might have thought he would say, we can't include the Jewish people because we have to worry that they're bamzerim because they act so bad. But that's not what he says. He says, Shema Yitarvu. They're going to mix in with the Jewish people, and they're going to marry women, and they're going to have their children will marry this. Oh, I'm sorry. He does say, I apologize. And there's going to be a lot of bamzerim. In other words, he said, you can't develop good, friendly Jewish relations with them and treat them as ordinary Jews because so many of them are mamzerim that you have this problem. But if some of the first generation, where you don't have to worry about mamzerim, return to the fold and they agree in public to observe mitzvot, and then any children born from after that, so they could be included, because we can, you know, and we can be careful and just know that they didn't have children. And so you might have in that community even, right? It becomes a community question. Let's suppose today, for example, you had somebody who lives in the conservative community, you'd be more likely in the reform community, live in the conservative community, but they make clear that even though they haven't left that community, but they make clear that they intend to keep halacha, at least the halachos of marriage and divorce, the ways that we do, and they do, as far as we know, keep those halachot. So those children, you can marry. Those children, if they eventually become fully observant, you can marry. And you have this all the time, right? You have the children of conservative or reformed Jews, so you have to check that they kept the halachot of divorce and marriage. You don't have to worry about mamzerut. And then if they become observant, since they want to marry an observant Jew, you can marry them. But anybody you have to worry about, then you have to make sure that they can't marry into the Jewish people. That's what Rav Netro Nigon was already saying. Therefore, Rav Uziel says, applying this to the Bnei Yisrael in India, so if you have families, and apparently there were some families who knew about mikvah, and they kept mikvah, and as far as you know, there's no history of divorce in their family, or no lack of chalitz in their family, because if a woman is a widow and her husband never had children, you're supposed to have a chalitz, and then there's also a question about what happens to the children of the second marriage, I think. So if you have none of those problems within a marriage, then it's an obligation to accept them as Jews and to try to bring them close to the Torah, but you have to make a condition with them that they will make a public acceptance. You can make a big party about it. It should be chagigi. It should be a big celebration that they are returning to full Torah observance. Especially, he says, especially the obligations of nida, of that when a woman has menstruates, that the husband and wife will separate, and then she'll go to mikvah, because he says that is yisod taharat ha-mishpacha. And I never really thought about it until into this context, right? But what he's saying is he thinks that leads to an overall purity of the family, an overall taharat of the mishpacha. And then based on what I've said, he says, based on all of this, you can see that if one of them becomes observant again, it could be that that if a Kohen has a son and he marries somebody, and has a son who marries somebody from this group, that they could have in that group even Kohanim Levi, meaning, you know, if an ordinary Jew marries a Bnei Yisrael woman, an ordinary Jewish Kohen marries a Bnei Yisrael woman, the child will come out looking at least somewhat like a Bnei Yisrael. So let's say that, and he's a Kohen, because as far as we know, they're good people, right? We've checked the lineages. So that half Bnei Yisrael Kohen might decide to marry another Bnei Yisrael woman, who's got a proper lineage, there's no problem. They might actually have another. So those children will be three-quarters Bnei Yisrael, right? So you could eventually have Kohanim and Levim from, who are really, you know, ethnically or racially, whatever the right word would be, Bnei Yisrael, and then you can include them in a minyan, and all those things you can do. But he says he thinks those who don't accept Torah and mitzvot, so we today would take a Jew who doesn't accept Torah and mitzvot, we would include them in a minyan, we would let them get an aliyah, and he says he thinks he shouldn't do it. He doesn't say we would do it. He says he doesn't talk about that people do it. He says he thinks you shouldn't do it because there's an chashash, he says, of Amram Gon, that if you, which I think we saw before, was not Renai Gon, but of Amram Gon, that if you let them down with you in a minyan, you let them get aliyot, and you treat them like ordinary Jews, you're going to end up marrying them. But, he repeats, the ones who are willing to accept Torah and mitzvot, then you can and should include the Jewish people. So that's the second Shuvah for the 24th of Kislev. It's Rav Uziel talking about the Bnei Yisrael and saying that, in fact, the Bnei Yisrael should be accepted with certain caveats. To the extent that we know that their lineage is okay, and they're willing to accept Torah and mitzvot, they should be fully accepted from the Jewish people. Moving, fast-forwarding ahead a few years to Chaf Dalet Kislev of Tufshin, you'd bet. There's actually two Shuvot in Rav Moshe Feinstein. I'm not sure we'll get to both. I'll try to get to both, although I'm running out of time. There's Igrot Moshe Orach Chaim Aleph Kuf Chaf Chet. When he's asked about using a thermometer on Shabbos, so the reason you might have thought you can't use a thermometer on Shabbos is because there's this idea that we don't do medical stuff on Shabbos. But that's really, as Rav Moshe Feinstein says, that's really an issue of medical stuff, of like grinding up anything that's like a food, like a pill. So there's some resistance in halacha, and we'll talk about that in a second, but there's some resistance in halacha to use that on Shabbat, because the Gemara spoke about a worry of shchikat samanim, that if you use herbs for those kinds of things, and you're used to grinding up herbs or making them into a medicine or a paste or whatever it was, and you do something else on Shabbos, we're worried that you might forget and also grind those herbs. So there's a general refraining from using medication on Shabbos. We'll get to that in a second, but another issue is that thermometers look like you're measuring something. There's another idea that have nothing to do with medical issues, that we don't measure things on Shabbos or Yom Tov. So the Rav Moshe Feinstein says, you got to know the prohibition of midida, of measuring things, is only a deoraita, is only a Torah prohibition when you're actually cutting off pieces of material or cutting out things at a very specific and exact measure on Shabbat. So that's where, let's say, our times, questions about things like paper towels and toilet paper come as a question of whether it's midida or not, mekatech or not, because you don't always care about the exact amount. And the d'oraita prohibition, at least, is you care about an exact amount. But other than that, it's a d'rabbanan. And when it's a d'rabbanan, it's rabbinic. The d'rabbanan was worried about mekach or memkach. The worry was not that you'll come to be mekatech, you'll come to violate the Torah prohibition. The worry was that you'll engage in business endeavors on Shabbos, and then they made it prohibited to measure things even in the house because of that whole thing. As Rashi says, because it looks like you're measuring it to sell it. That also says because it looks too much like your weekday activities. But it seems obvious to Moshe Feinstein that all of those is about medida, where you're measuring things that you're going to then use. You're measuring weight. You're measuring length of something. You're trying to create a certain, you know, size of paper. Right. So those are all kinds of problems. Cutting off silver foil might be an example of that. Right? Those are all the kinds of problems. But when it comes to a thermometer, you're not measuring in that sense. You're not coming out with something of a certain measure. You're measuring the heat inside the person's body. So Moshe Feinstein thinks there's not even a d'rabbanan there, because it's not similar to the measuring that we're talking about. So therefore, if you want to be meikel on it, he thinks there's no reason to object to it. And if it's to take the temperature of somebody who's a little ill, even though he's not dangerously ill, he says it's obviously permissible. And he quotes a Mishnah Berurah who says that a medida, that rifuah, any kind of healing of people other than giving them drugs, giving them medication, because medication gets to the discussion of maybe you're going to grind something. But other than that, any kind of help you can give to people, you're it's a mitzvah to do. You're supposed to do it to help people feel better. So the measuring with the thermometer will help us in that way, and therefore he thinks there's no problem whatsoever. Then he throws it at the end of the tshuva, when it comes to opening the door of a refrigerator. Now, this is 1951, I think I said. Yeah, it's the 24th of Kislev of Tufshin Yud Bet of 5712, which is 1951. I'm pretty sure late 51. It's important to remember to me that home refrigerators were still fairly new. 1913 is like the first home refrigerator. Then in the 1920s, I looked this up on Wikipedia. Yeah, Freon introduced, so you get more home refrigerators, but separate freezers came out in 1940. This is a very early stage of accessory. Moshe Feinstein says, I'm not willing to rule on this, and because there's ways to think about it both ways. He's really uncomfortable with the idea of whether or not you're supposed to can open refrigerators on Shabbos. And then he says, I also want to write about turning off the gas on a gas flame like on an oven on Yom Tov. I don't want to put it in writing. Right? I don't know. I think he wanted to say something. It might be that he had a cooler leniency that he was afraid to put in writing, or he was unwilling to put in writing. But it says in terms of lowering the flame so that the food won't burn or will, you know, cook better, that's obviously allowed, because it's like a case in the Gemara that you have, and that's obviously allowed. So there is another tshuva from Moshe Feinstein on this, written on the 24th of Kislev Tufshin Yud Bet, but I think we've run out of time. So God willing, maybe another time we will have a chance to talk about the issues of whether a husband can eat food off the wife's plate while she's in Ida. But for now, we're going to have to stop. Thank the OU, Rabbi Jacob Abramowitz, David Hochhauser. Wish you a good day. This is a responsibility of the 24th of Kislev.